I wanted more people to listen to the podcast, so I stopped sharing so much on the page. And I was, once I canceled, spoiler alert, I was like, you know what, I'm just going to put it all on the page.
Well, good. I'm glad you got back to it, because that's basically the root of where it all came from.
Exactly. Exactly. That I have time for. Yeah. That takes 2 seconds.
Even when writing scripts for The Grass is Greener.
Yes.
That's a good thing. So.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sitting in for Louie today.
No problem. I'm always on call. I'm a short order cook.
Welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamfrone, and welcome to another edition where we talk about health, wellness, and issues in medicine today. Great to be here, and we have a fabulous guest, Dr. Joshua Yamamoto, and he wrote a great book with his wife, who is also a physician, Kristen Thomas, called You Can Prevent a Stroke, The Foxhole Foundation. So our guest has lots of accolades. He graduated with a degree in physics from Princeton University, so we'll have to ask him some quantum questions. He worked as a paramedic for the fire department, like myself, and then he went to Dartmouth Medical School, and he trained at Johns Hopkins, and then he became a cardiologist at the National Naval Medical Center in Georgetown. And then he was a cardiology consultant to the U.S. Congress and director of cardiac imaging, and then he also served in Kuwait. So he's quite an accomplished doctor, and we're really happy to have him here. He also has a great radio voice, so welcome, Dr. Yamamoto.
My pleasure. Pleasure to be here, Dr. Z.
Great, okay. So... you know, the book is about preventing strokes, but it's a lot more than that. It talks a little bit about, you know, the difference between prevention and early detection, and because, you know, some people think that they're the same. I don't think that, you know, as a real preventive medicine trained doctor. But let's talk a little bit about how the book is laid out and why you decided to write the book.
Well, we decided to write the book initially when one of my patients came to me and asked, hey, Dr. Y, what's the best way to treat a stroke? And I just looked at him and said, that is the wrong question. The best thing to do is to prevent a stroke. And he was quite taken aback because, like so many of us, we were taught that strokes are basically these tragic random events. And they're certainly tragic, but they're not at all random. The things that lead us to have a stroke are largely predictable and thereby measurable and manageable things that we can proactively go about preventing a stroke from happening in the first place.
Absolutely, yeah. So one of the things that you talk about quite a bit in the book is the idea of inflammation as a big hallmark of possible stroke happening or the inflammation of your arteries. But I know that inflammation is kind of like a natural part of our body. You know, when we get a wound, it goes through the inflammatory cascade and mechanisms happen, and then eventually we get healing. So is there a difference between the chronic inflammation that we see and seems to be rampant in society versus the acute inflammation that our body uses to heal ourselves all the time?
Well, acute inflammation or repair of an injury and the chronic inflammation overlap quite a bit. And this is where my background as a physics major, and forgive me, I delightfully know little about biology, but physics is a mechanical thing. And we have 100,000 heartbeats every single day. So that's, in a way, relentless acute trauma with every single heartbeat. And we're obviously well-designed to tolerate that, but there are things that go along with that. And imagine our cave-dwelling ancestors. We all died of wounds, bleeding, malnutrition, infection. And so for tens of thousands of years, we've evolved to be very good at confronting that. So we heal well. Now, if you slap your skin on the outside 100,000 times a day, you will develop scabs and scars and heal that. And those of us who heal the best win. But on the inside, our relentless healing is in fact the mechanism of aging. And we are going to age when our circulation ages, and aging is inevitable. Our circulation is going to change, but the good news is that this gives us a terrific opportunity to understand how we're aging and to be proactive in how we go through life.
But is there a difference between chronological aging and biological aging? Like sometimes a patient comes in front of me and I, you know, looking at their license for their insurance and ID, and I kind of, I don't say this because I'd be embarrassed, but I look at them and say, wow, the collagen on the outside has been pretty much ravaged, whether it's the sun or they're smoking or other oxidative factors. I wonder what's going on with the collagen inside their body, and often they have osteoarthritis and other collagen-based illnesses. Collagen is a huge part of the framework of our vascular system. Am I right?
That's absolutely correct. Collagen is one of the principal building blocks of everything in our body. We can see it when it ages on the outside, as you say, when our skin begins to weather and our bones and joints start to wear down. But our blood vessels, our arteries that carry blood throughout the body, are in large part made of collagen as well. And collagen ages. The cell biologists have taught us that collagen is what they call an incomplete protein, meaning with time, it changes its characteristics. It becomes stiffer. Everybody's arteries get stiffer, just like we can't avoid getting older and having wrinkles and the change of our bones and joints. And see, the stiffness of arteries makes our pipes stiffer. And stiffer pipes mean or may mean higher pressure. So we tell people, oh, you have high blood pressure, but it's not the pressure. Blood pressure is a number. What the issue is, what is the health of the arteries? How much work does it take your heart to pump through those arteries? We care about the work on the heart. We care about the stiffness and resistance to flow in the arteries because as the arteries age and the heart then has to be overworked, that causes a series of changes which can ultimately lead to a failing heart and predispose us to trouble with circulation to the brain or lead to a stroke. And again, there is good news because aging is inevitable, but there are things we can do to help navigate that process. Fitness, for example. Nothing is perhaps more powerful than fitness at maintaining good, flexible arteries to improve blood flow. And it's not just about a number. It's not just about saying, I need to have a great blood pressure number. It's about the whole picture. To look at yourself as a whole and say, my circulation is healthy. My heart doesn't have to overwork. I am cutting down the chronologic aging on the inside.
Right, yeah. And I know blood pressure is certainly a big issue. You were talking about it's a number, but there's so many factors associated with blood pressure. How come it's treated in medicine as like one thing when I know you have blood viscosity? You know, as a physicist, you know about, of course, viscosity and flow dynamics pretty well. There's so many things and reasons why the blood can be too thick. Some people think it's too much fibrin. Some people think it has to do with what I call maple syrup blood, which is glycation. I know that you're a fan of people keeping their blood sugars down. Arterial stiffness, you mentioned, but then there's also other factors like, you know, stress hormones and cortisol and salt. So it's blood pressure is really not a disease. It's a syndrome, right?
That is, I could not agree with you more. Blood pressure, we report that as if it's one number and that means everything, but it's just part of the whole package of the health of our heart and circulation. And if we ask, why do we focus so much on the number, at least when I went to medical school, the bias was to teach doctors, when something is broken, here's how you fix it. And that's truly a dated mindset. And I think we can all agree that there are so many factors that change how things work. I would take my car to the shop to keep the motor running well before it catches fire. I don't need it to break to try to do everything I can to keep it working well. So looking at blood pressure as the be-all and end-all is selling us short, because you're right. If our decreased vascular resistance to flow, decreased flexibility of the arteries, the biologic characteristics of our blood. I chuckle when you talk about maple syrup, because I went to medical school in New Hampshire, and I can say I've once tried to tap a tree to get maple syrup. It never seems to work as well as you'd like, but the thing is, you have to think of what's on the inside, what's going through the pipes, and the health of the heart. So one of the things that we advocate at the Foxall Foundation, we have a memory device that we call DeHart, D-H-A-R-T, as in, it's DeHart, silly, this is what we need to be thinking about. D is work with your doctor. Don't think we can do this alone, but the H-A-R is to ask, well, what is the health of my heart? What are the health of my arteries? And what are my rhythms? How is my heart beating? And then T is a time for me to do something different. Because you listed a great number of things that influence the health of our circulation, and different people, different factors at different times will have different priorities. Mm-hmm. But now can we skip to the end and say, well, how am I doing? All of these things that may make my heart overwork, how is it doing? Because that the heart can change long before we feel it. Can you look? What's the health of my heart? The answer is, of course we can look. We have all sorts of ways of answering, what's the health of my heart? And what are the health of my arteries? And is my heart being irregular? And do I know that? Because that matters a great deal as well.
So let's break it down and talk about some of these kind of factors that we can dissect it out, so to speak. So let's go with the maple syrup thing. It's kind of funny. I live in Connecticut, and I tap the trees, too, and I'm pretty successful making the maple syrup. It's kind of funny. I never eat it, though, because it's not really good for my blood sugar, like a lot of people. So I give it away as gifts. I'm kind of poisoning my friends and relatives, I guess, in a way. But sugar can become a metabolic poison in certain people and create this whole glycation. And I think people with diabetes don't really realize how toxic sugar can be. If you look at you go on PubMed and look at all the literature on glycation and how it actually generates free radicals and how it binds to collagen, either the N or the C part of the protein, and creates this kind of alien molecule. It's almost like I remember going to see the Bodies exhibit when they were touring around the world, and we got a good glimpse of the bodies dissected, although in medical school you and I got a chance to see that real up front.
Up close.
Yeah, but you could see that they probably injected some type of a chemical to vulcanize these people's collagen and make them into rubber, and they were on exhibit. The same thing kind of happens, I think, with abnormal blood sugar. Am I right?
The blood sugar and all the metabolic pathways that you're describing, far and away, are the biggest, what I call, accelerators of aging. Mm. We traditionally have been taught about risk factors, and that is a good starting point. High blood sugar or diabetes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol and smoking. But as you're saying, these aren't just risk factors. And I shy away from the term risk factor because it sounds like, well, if I avoid the risk factor, nothing bad ever happens. And that's folly, because we're all going to age. And sugar, the metabolic syndrome, diabetes in its end stage, is the thing that accelerates aging more than anything. I often talk to my patients and say, why do we care about diabetes? And the answer is, we care because, well, higher sugars And all the things associated with that will accelerate vascular aging, which means we can develop plaque and poor circulation. And then I'll ask, well, what part of the human body depends upon good circulation? And you know what? That's just about everything, with the possible exception of the lens of our eyes. So I never knew much about cataracts, but every other part of the body needs circulation. And diabetes and the sugar-related inflammatory issues accelerate vascular aging more than anything. In fact, I think I would be more concerned over somebody who had poor sugar health than I would a smoker. Not that I want you to smoke, but
wow.
Just to give it a magnitude of how right you are into being mindful of the metabolic pathways that accelerate vascular aging.
So we certainly have to look at the current lab values that, you know, are out there and try to get people's fasting blood sugar and insulin a lot lower.
That's absolutely true. One of the things I'm fond of saying is that I don't claim expertise in how to treat diabetes. I can just tell you as my patient how important that is and how important it is to prevent or avoid getting diabetes. And then somebody like me, who is a circulatory doctor,
right.
If you come to me, I'll say, all right, you've been working with somebody on your diet, avoiding the metabolic syndrome, avoiding the sugars. How are we doing? We care because it can really accelerate your aging. So let me take a peek, and I can ultrasound your arteries. I can look directly at the arteries going to the brain, the carotid arteries. And some folks, they look great. You have terrific flow, only minimal changes, if that, and then you can have the comfort of saying, I've been doing a good job. But in far too many cases, people are trying as hard as they can, but their genetics and time are conspiring to age their circulation, and they can have enormous amounts of plaque buildup going right up to their brain. And at that point, you can have a heart-to-heart with your doctor and say, look, what can I do better? This is my current diet. This is my lifestyle. What can I do? And, doc, you're my doctor. Is it time for me to add to that? I'm not, believe it or not, I prescribe pills for a living, but I'm never thrilled to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But if I reach the point to say, all right, you've done everything that I've asked, you're doing as hard as you can, but look, you still have this plaque. And you know what? It's growing, because I saw it last year, and I saw it now. You have growing plaque. So maybe we do need to cross the line and say, fine, I'm not going to give you a pill because of some number, but I'm going to treat you as a person. And if you're doing the best you can, and I'm giving you the best advice I can, if we need to go the next step and take medication, then so be it. But let's do it thoughtfully and for purpose, because we're trying to prevent a stroke. We're not just treating numbers.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. There's also, like you mentioned, other factors that kind of damage the arteries. So you said just the pressure itself can damage the arteries. But are there other things that actually cause the lesion? Because I think that's like, maybe you could explain to listeners, they're very confused about lipids and LDL and VLDL and the size of the LDL. And, you know, it's actually kind of confusing to me sometimes, too. And, you know, apoproteins and the lipid profile. So spend maybe a few moments talking about, because I heard that LDL, this is some new papers that have been published, that LDL is actually an oxidative marker, and the body's trying to patch some damage that's happening to the arteries, so the liver makes this stuff to kind of patch it, almost like spackle in a way.
Exactly. What you're mentioning is that the biology of vascular healing, chronic and acute inflammation, and age is actually quite complicated. And there are many, many factors, and there are now dozens and dozens of lab tests and what we call biomarkers. And guess what? They all associate to certain degrees with growing plaque and vascular aging. With the one exception of HDL is typically a good thing, but everything else is basically bad. And so what I like to tell folks is, rather than looking at every leaf on this tree, you can mark out different biomarkers, and sometimes that makes sense for an individual. But if you take a step back and just say, well, what is going on? How can I, as just a normal person and not a cell biologist, approach this? And I tell folks, look, all right, you start with your genetics, and your genetics are going to dictate how you respond to stress and healing, whether it's oxidative stress, mechanical stress, shear stress, what have you. And then as you go through time, and we've been beating on your arteries 100,000 times a day, times 365, times 50, 60, 70 years or whatever, how have your arteries aged? And we know the things we can do. See, I was also in the Navy. In the Navy, we like to talk about actionable intelligence. So if I'm going to do a test or ask a question or get information, can it lead me to a treatment point? Now, I know everybody should exercise, but I can look at your heart and really give you guidance as to whether you're doing enough, and I can look at you on a treadmill and tell you if you should be doing more. And I know everybody should eat well, but, you know, different parts of the world have different indigenous diets, and matching nutrition to genetics is beyond my personal intelligence and perhaps beyond all of ours to give everyone an exact answer to say, oh, you need to eat this one fruit and you'll live forever. I'm not sure we'll ever get there, but we can say, look, you know, what did your grandparents eat? What was their diet like? And we have a delightfully heterogeneous genetic population in this country and really delightfully heterogeneous food. And this mismatch creates all of these different variables that you mentioned, and all of them can accelerate plaque growth. And so I don't think I'm ever clever enough to tell you what is going to happen. I simply can look at your arteries and tell you what has happened to say, all right, where's our action point? Do you need to reassess your diet? Do you need to actually consider medication? Do you need to quit smoking? That's easy. The answer to that is always yes. And so all of these factors mark different parts of a very complicated system, but the end result is aging of the artery. And if you're growing plaque, and if the plaque keeps growing, then me as a person and you as my physician, we need to do something better. And so one of our key points is, one, well, everybody ages. None of us are immune from aging. Two, we have the ability to know our health on the inside when we look. And three, with that knowledge, then we're empowered to understand our choices and to know, find out what are the things we can do to be more preventive.
And so some of those tests that maybe you can explain to listeners what they would expect to do if they were to go to a cardiologist. Not everyone has gone to a cardiologist. I have. I got a good workup recently. But, you know, there's everything from stress tests to echocardiograms to EKGs, so it's a whole foreign world to people and can be a little daunting. So maybe you could make it a little safer for people.
Well, the good news is that in 2019, our tests to look at our heart, to look at our arteries, and to look at our circulation, our rhythms, they're generally painless and non-invasive. In the old days, there was a lot of poking, prodding, needles, catheters, which sometimes needs to be done, but not to start. Mm-hmm. As a preventive cardiologist, I would love to see everybody eventually, but you can start with just your family doctor or any primary doctor can begin asking the question. History, asking questions and understanding your life and your family background is of great value, and we should never underestimate how important it is to just ask questions. And an examination, we should never cut ourselves short from taking the time to let our doctor take our blood pressure, listen to our heart, because it's amazing what we can find. But then from there, you start asking questions. An EKG is putting a couple of stickers on your chest to look at your heart's electrical signal, and that's a very simple thing. We could even do that in an ambulance, for crying out loud. And that EKG is a nice little snapshot to say, well, what rhythm is your heart in now? And it can give us an inference or a clue as to the structure and function of the heart. And if you want to see the structure and function of the heart, which is very important, well, that's easy. You can just put a little warm gel and take an ultrasound using the same technology we look at babies with to look at your heart. in a lot of training programs now, even our internal medicine and family doctors are learning how to ultrasound the heart because it's fundamentally a physical exam, and we're cheating because we can just see inside. If I want to know how your heart's doing, I don't have to guess. I can just look. And it's typically something readily covered under insurance, even Medicare. If for almost any reason, if you want to ask what the health of my heart is, oh, I have borderline blood pressure, oh, I, you know, thought I heard a funny heart sound, you can get somebody to look at your heart. And when you do, you can find out an awful lot about your health that you wouldn't necessarily know from symptoms. And getting on a treadmill, we used to call this a stress test, and the term is hopefully soon to be a little outdated as well, because that implies it's a pass-fail venture. I tell folks all the time, look, nobody's going to beat my machine. It's going to go faster and steer. I've put Navy SEALs on this machine. The machine will always win. The question is, when you are physically active, going through whatever activity you can do, how does your body respond? Because you know what? We all reach a limit. What is it that makes us reach that limit? Is my pressure fine when I'm sitting still, but way too high when I exercise? That happens when we lose vascular compliance with older, stiffer arteries. Does my heart race when I exercise? Does my heart actually beat too slowly when I exercise? There's a very common problem that particularly our older folks have, and they don't realize. Oh, my heart's always been slow. Well, you know, now you're 75, you're not an Olympic athlete anymore. That slow heart is preventing you from circulating blood, which is why you're tired all the time. Do you get limited because you do have plaque buildup and you're not getting enough blood to your heart or to your body? Or do you start walking and have an irregular heartbeat? It's surprising how many people have atrial fibrillation that you unmask when you actually watch them exercise. So we like to say if you want to know how the heart works, look at it. And you can ask your doctor for a functional test, which is basically a treadmill augmented with ultrasound to see your heart. But there are many, many other ways one can look at the heart and look at arteries to know what your health on the inside is. There's never a one-size-fits-all. And you know as well as I do that new technologies keep coming, and they all have information to give us. It's what do we do with that information that ultimately matters.
Have you ever heard or done the calcium score of the arteries? I know they're doing that at Hartford Hospital, and I was curious as to if you've done any reading on that.
So what a calcium score tells us is there evidence of arterial aging, particularly in the arteries to your heart?
Oh, I see.
You mentioned that sugar in particular can activate an inflammatory cascade, and inflammation or the healing process changes arteries. And at first that change is a little thickening of the wall of the artery, and then as plaque grows, plaque is not something that sticks on an artery. Plaque is not just made out of cholesterol. Plaque is a healing process. And the final stages of that healing process is organization, as we call it, and that organization eventually hardens up. It calcifies. So the last stage, if you will, of inflammation in an artery is calcification. Bones are calcified. You can see that with an x-ray. We actually had data from decades ago in the military. You could take a chest x-ray of a pilot, and if he saw calcium in their heart, we knew that was a bad thing. We didn't quite necessarily know why, but what it was accelerated vascular aging, and we now understand that's just atherosclerosis. So a coronary calcium scan is a nice high-tech way of getting a quick snapshot. It's easy. It's technically simple. You just lie on a table. It's basically a fancy x-ray without too much radiation. And if you have evidence of aging of your arteries, well then, what do we do with that information? You say, okay, I need to know, is this enough that I need to be on medication? Maybe. to me, it's a great excuse to have somebody come see me as a cardiologist, because then I'm going to say, well, this is a nice test. It prompted you to come see me. You came to see me. This test tells me the arteries of your heart have some atherosclerosis. It's been there long enough to calcify. But, you know, the most dangerous plaque is the early plaque, because it's soft and mushy, and it likes to break off and clot up. So the calcium doesn't necessarily tell me everything I need to know about how to help you, but I can put you on a treadmill, I can watch your heart with the ultrasound, I can make sure things work. Then we can have a good discussion about things you can do and things that I can do, meaning let's look at your nutritional profile. Let us not gloss over how important, you know, the metabolic syndrome and diabetes and diet can be. Let us talk about your fitness. And if we need to, let's talk about, is it time for a pill? Do we need to be on a medicine to arrest plaque growth? And notice, we don't just treat cholesterol, we arrest plaque growth. Do we need to improve blood flow? We don't just treat blood pressure, we can promote the health of arteries. And do I need to protect you from having that these arteries clot up? Should you be one of the people on an aspirin? And the answer is probably yes, if you have enough plaque that we can see it on a calcium score.
Okay, so let's take a break, play some station IDs and our natural medicine chest little program. And when we come back, we want to talk about AFib, because that's sort of something that creates the risk for strokes, and talk about some other misconceptions with strokes and common challenges, what you call the litany of stubbornness, which I think is great. And we'll be back with more. Dr. Yamamoto, great to have you, and stay with us.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from Progressive Voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the nutrient known as taurine.
Amino acids are chemical constituents that form the building blocks of protein in the body. The official definition of an amino acid is a compound which contains an amino group and a carboxylic acid. Taurine contains a sulfonic group instead, so is not a true amino acid, although it is often referred to as one. The intracellular concentration of taurine is 10 times that of any normal free amino acid.
Taurine was discovered in 1827, but the significance of taurine in nutrition was not realized until 1975, when the journal Science published a study showing that taurine-deficient cats suffered from retinal degeneration. In 1986, the Annual Review of Biochemistry reported that the amount of taurine present in mammalian milk depends on the species. Natural human mother's milk is rich in taurine, but cow's milk, except for the early milk known as colostrum, is taurine deficient. Pediatrics Journal in 1983 printed a study which outlined several of the biologically significant functions of taurine, and an effort was then made to fortify infant formula by adding taurine.
Some species of animals, such as cats, cannot synthesize taurine within their bodies, and so must receive it through their diets. Humans have a very limited ability to synthesize taurine, so adequate intake through diet and supplementation is important. The principal source of dietary taurine is meat of various types and shellfish. Even people ingesting sufficiently high levels of taurine may develop a deficiency due to the overgrowth of certain anaerobic intestinal microorganisms which consume taurine. Certain prescription drugs are known inhibitors of taurine uptake.
The Journal of Neurochemistry published a study in 1975 which showed that taurine concentrations are extremely high in the retina. In fact, the retina contains two binding proteins specific for taurine. Research has yet to determine exactly how taurine functions in the eye, but deficiency of taurine has been found to lead to the degeneration of photoreceptor cells. Continued studies on taurine have linked its presence to several biological functions, besides being a protector of the delicate tissues of the eye. Taurine helps to neutralize oxidizing agents caused by ionizing radiation. Taurine is present in high concentrations in the normal heart. It stimulates white blood cell motility and protects cell membranes from free radical damage. Taurine has proven useful in epileptics to reduce or control seizures. It helps modulate the transport of substances such as sodium, potassium, magnesium, copper, and iron across cell membranes. Additional research supports taurine's role in preventing gallstones.
So, as you can see, the nutrient taurine may be an important addition to your natural medicine chest.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
And welcome back to the program, and this is Dr. Z, and Natural Nurse has the week off, and we're having a great discussion with cardiologist Dr. Josh Yamamoto, and he's the author, along with his wife, who's also a physician. Her name's Kristen Thomas. Can you prevent a stroke? And we're really talking about going deep into the reasons for strokes and talking about not only what causes some of the underlying causes of things like strokes and vascular stiffening and arterial noncompliance and high blood pressure and blood viscosity and things like that, but we're also talking about testing so that you're not fearful of seeking help when that's an interesting point. Welcome back, Dr. Yamamoto. Great to have you. People are afraid of going to the doctors sometimes, I guess it's maybe the fear of the unknown or fear that you're going to hear some bad news, which I could see. I'm human. When I go to the doctors, and I'm a physician myself, I sort of have those same emotions come up, too. I think it's only human.
It's absolutely human, and perhaps one of the most useful things I learned from my time in the Navy is that some things you just need to do, meaning any sailor is forced to have physicals, and after a while you just become accepting of the process, and that may not be the most humane way for us to take care of soldiers and sailors, but every one of us deserves the same questioning. Mm. As a sailor, we're asked to stay healthy enough to fulfill our mission. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not a doctor, how am I supposed to know if I'm doing a good enough job? Now, all of us as people know we should eat well and exercise, and that's terrific. But it's nice to work with a doctor to say, hey, okay, I get it. I'm going to grow older. You know, we take our kids to the pediatrician. We're very dutiful. And we know that even if we don't necessarily want to take them and they have to get a shot or something, this is part of how we keep our children healthy. And our daughters go to doctors forever. We men, we're kind of lousy at it. We reach a certain point and says, you know, if it's not falling off, I'm okay. But we treat our cars better than we treat our bodies. Mm. At least I do, or I used to anyway. I keep an eye on things in my car. I know the tires wear. I know the brakes wear. I know I got to change the oil. I know that if I want to keep this nice car running for a long time, which I do, I'm not a guy who gets a new car every 3 years. I would like to run it forever. I know that requires some maintenance. So I've crossed the threshold. And I'm like you. I wouldn't go to a doctor if my wife didn't make me. But now I've learned that, hey, this is great. I'm going to go in and say, hey, I think I'm doing a great job. Help me know what I can do to be proactive, because I acknowledge that time passes. Mother Nature always wins, but I'd rather she not win when I'm 50. How about when I'm 105? Then great. And I have more 100-year-old patients now who have taken that attitude of saying, I want to navigate aging well. Help me do that.
Great way to, I like the way you put that, navigate aging. So the foxhole formula, that's your steps to prevent a stroke that you called DHEART. You outlined it again, but talk a little bit about your that philosophy or your mission there.
The DHEART formula is all based on understanding what are the preventable causes of strokes. And traditional medical training had us look at people only after they had a stroke. We seem to spend a lot of effort once you've had a brain injury. I mean, to be clear, a stroke is a cerebrovascular accident. Cerebro meaning our brain, vascular meaning circulation, and accident is clearly a bad thing. So we damaged the brain because of a problem with circulation. When I was in med school, if someone came in with brain damage from a stroke, we'd say, oh my goodness, let's look at their arteries to see if we can figure out why that happened. It's like, really? We're going to look now, afterwards? Let's look at their heart. I mean, that's what we did, right? This is the standard, quote, workup of a stroke. Well, why did this happen? Well, why do we care? Oh, so it doesn't happen a second time. Well, how about that first time? And that's kind of the new way of thinking. We don't have to wait for you to have a stroke to say, whoa, okay, aging is inevitable. It's going to change our arteries. It's going to change our heart. And as you mentioned before the break, there's a lot of irregular heartbeats going on called atrial fibrillation. And that is possibly one of the biggest quiet drivers of strokes.
Well, there's two types of strokes, right? Let's go back to the basics a little bit for the listeners. I know there's the type of stroke where you actually, well, you can explain it better than I can. Tell us about the different types of strokes and a TIA and differentiate those for us.
So a stroke, again, a cerebrovascular accident, meaning damage to the brain because of a problem with circulation. And that problem with circulation is usually interrupted or inadequate blood flow. You're not getting enough blood to the brain because something clotted off, or there's some issue where you just don't get enough blood to the head at all. There is the minority of strokes where a blood vessel can actually bleed, and that's typically related to folks who have higher pressure and smoke. But it's important to know that, well, we already know you shouldn't smoke, but the majority of strokes, in our aging population really have to do with the clotting. A TIA, as you mentioned, is the name we apply to something typically called mini strokes. T stands for transient, meaning the symptoms can come and go. You can interrupt or block circulation and then it can maybe get better. Ischemia is a term used also widely in Europe. I have a lot of European patients who come and they say, I don't want to have ischemia. What does that mean? That means you're not getting enough blood where you need it, particularly the brain attack. TIA, transient ischemic attack, so a mini stroke where you cut off the blood flow a little bit to some part of the brain. And if it gets better, great. We say it was a TIA. And if it causes irreversible damage, we say it's a stroke. And as you might imagine, there's a spectrum. And so we really like to advocate, well, we know the things that lead to TIAs and strokes. Let's find out how our health is on the inside before any of those things happen.
Right. And what are some of the symptoms that people are starting to have problems with, even cardiovascular disease? We didn't even kind of discuss that. I guess we should really, because they could be something that could be as benign as having cold hands and feet and things like that. I mean, that could be a zillion things, that's for sure, in the differential diagnosis. But what are some of the things that people should be looking out for?
Well, we like to point out that using symptoms can be to guide us is often a late thing, although the symptoms are important. One of our very, very bad jokes, perhaps, is to say, waiting for symptoms to look for important heart and vascular disease is like using an altimeter to look for a waterfall, meaning that by the time this gauge is spinning, when you're plummeting to your doom, you really missed an opportunity long before to redirect your course. So we try to understand our health before we have a lot of symptoms, before we have a heart attack or a brain attack, which is another name for a stroke. That being said, we like to refer to what I call the universal symptom, meaning our heart is a pump, and our circulatory system, we have to pump blood and nutrition and oxygen to every part of the body. And so if the pump or any part of our circulation is not up to snuff, then whatever part of the body is not getting blood flow as much as it likes can start to suffer. Well, you know what? That's everything. So without a doubt, the most common early symptom of an aging circulation or a problem is simply fatigue. Oh, my goodness. We all get tired. And I have so many folks say to me, oh, I'm getting older. That's why I'm so tired. Well, you're getting older. You also have arterial buildup. You haven't been staying fit. You've lost vascular compliance. Your heart has been overworked, and it's now not pumping when you need it to. Maybe your heart's too slow, or maybe you're in atrial fibrillation. All of these things, meaning if there is an issue with my heart or my pipes or my blood flow, the first thing most people feel is fatigue or what is called exercise intolerance, meaning, oh, I feel fine. Great. Show me. Show me that you are fine. What I mean by that is I'll put absolutely anybody on a treadmill. I've had literally people 98 years old get up and walk on a treadmill. They don't run as fast as the Navy SEALs, fine, but I can watch them walk. You may feel fine, but when you're up and walking, things may not be working, and you may actually have stopped exercising because you had significant symptoms when you were trying to do any work. And unfortunately, I have met people for the first time that have had bypass surgery within a couple hours of meeting me, and their spouses bring them in because they say, you know, he's not right. Oh, I feel fine. Good, show me. Let's just go for a walk. And you push the big red button on the treadmill that says, no, we need to stop, because you may say you're feeling fine, but only when you're sitting still. So show me how you feel when you're moving. Are you tired? Are you dizzy? Are you breathless? Do you have discomfort in your chest? Are your legs feeling weak? It's all the same. It's my system isn't working for me when I need it to.
Now, I guess folks can be out of shape, though, right? I mean, with less mitochondria in their muscles causing problems with fatigue too. So it's not, but you're saying that is a hallmark, though.
That's that. When I meet people who are just out of shape, that's delightful. And I say that because we can work on that. You and I, we can work on that. I can help devise an exercise program for you. And if what limits you on the treadmill is nothing more than your fitness, that is the best possible outcome. Because fitness will ultimately limit us. And as you're pointing out, fitness is how well do we use energy? What is our mitochondrial efficiency? How well... Our muscles have to do stuff. We have to deliver them oxygen. We have to take off the carbon dioxide, and they have to burn with efficiency. That I use the term fitness to describe all of that.
Mm-hmm. And the heart's a muscle, right? The heart's a muscle, Doc.
The heart is a unique muscle.
Yeah, right.
It can burn almost anything, and it doesn't need us to tell it to work. Mm. Our body muscles only... do something. Muscle contracts, and our body muscles contract when we tell it to. The heart doesn't need us to do that. It will beat on its own. And that's also another very important point. The heart tells itself when to beat, and the heart has a natural pacemaker, which I call the drum major of the band. The drum major of the band calls out the tempo, keep the heart in rhythm. But you know what? Our drum majors age. We all got taught in medical school that your max predicted heart rate is 220 minus your age. And if I go to the gym, I can look at this big chart on the wall that has this graph that says, well, what do we expect your heart rate to do as you get older? And I call it the graph of everything as we get older. It's just a slope that goes down. And you can look at that chart and say, okay, if I'm 70 years old, I'm not going to run as fast as when I'm 17. And that's not what this graph is telling us. I have 85-year-old marathon runners who could outrun me when I was 18. Your fitness can be as fit as you can keep it throughout your entire life, But the drum major that picks up the tempo is going to age, and there's really not much we can do about that. And that matters because the heart, as a muscle, uniquely will tell itself to beat. And if the drum major isn't so reliable, it's just like our marching band. If it doesn't hear somebody calling a cadence, the band gets out of step, and we have irregularity. Whether you could be perfectly healthy, but still have irregularity, that's what we call atrial fibrillation. And you may not even know you have it. If you're a healthy person, you can have irregularity. But it really matters, because when our heart is irregular, when the band is out of step, the blood in our system doesn't flow as smoothly, and that promotes clotting. And a clot that leaves the heart lands in the brain and gives us a stroke. So this is why, as you mentioned, atrial fibrillation is very common with age, and we don't always feel it or even know about it until after we've had a stroke. So you need to think about, what is my heart's rhythm? Am I likely to be having atrial fibrillation? Because there are many things we can do about it if that's the case.
So when the heart, so it's not in cadence, and you're having problems with the pumping into the various chambers, but what's the rub with why that causes viscosity changes and clotting? What would the mechanism be for the listeners out there? I know there's all kinds of theories of the platelets get damaged and then they release clotting factors, etc. But are there other reasons for that?
So there are many things that contribute to how we form a clot. But something that will always promote a blood clot is what we call stasis, meaning if blood stops moving and holds still, it's going to clot. And by and large, that's a good thing, because if you have a cut, the blood comes out and sits there. It gets the message, I'm not supposed to be sitting still. Our blood should never be still. It's always supposed to be moving. And so when it does sit still, it starts to clot. And when we have the irregular cadence of atrial fibrillation, the entry part of the heart, the top of the heart where blood returns to the heart, is called the atria, like the atria of a building. That atria is kind of quivering, and it lends itself to stagnation. So there's some back corners on the edges of the heart where the blood can really just sit still when we're in atrial fibrillation. And simply sitting still will encourage clotting. And then, as you mentioned, there is a host of other biologic factors that in some people, they really clot effectively, and the clot can form, and then the clot can grow. And if that clot then gets big enough where pieces of it break free and get back into the blood flow, well, that's the problem, because then the heart pumps this clot somewhere else. A lot of us have heard of the notion of the DVT, or the deep vein thrombosis, like a clot in our legs when we're on an airplane.
Yeah.
Well, atrial fibrillation is really the ultimate DVT, because as blood returns to our heart, it's coming from the veins. In this case, the veins of the lung come back to the heart. So it's really not moving very fast. And it collects in the atria, waiting to move into the pumping part of the heart, or the ventricle. And so it's like a venous clot. So if you're in AFib, it's kind of like being stuck in an airplane and coach for 13 hours. Or if you're in AFib for days or weeks, imagine being stuck there and not moving. And so that blood clots, or it can clot. And that's nothing we would feel but a horrible cause of strokes.
And there's a lot of ways to thin your blood. I mean, you know, everything from polyphenols that we find in, great foods, that those have been shown evidence-based to thin our blood, and fish oils can thin our blood, and certainly spices have been shown to thin our blood, and ginger, and there's all kinds of ways to manage these things dietetic-wise. But then there's some folks that when that doesn't work, that they do need some medications to manage the thinning of their blood. But then I know there's some limitations in the diet if they're on Coumadin, and so that's why I'm kind of like, you know, I call it rat poison.
Rat poison, but, absolutely. I am totally with you on my disdain of rat poison. It was a medicine, as you mentioned, developed by the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, or WARF, to kill rats back in 1954. And if it tried to be introduced today, there's no way on earth the FDA would ever approve its use, because it's just too hard and too dangerous to use. Now, there are newer medications and potentially procedures. Not everybody needs the same answer. Right. So, again, we're advocates of saying, ask the question. So everyone who has the first thing is, no, do I have atrial fibrillation? And it's not an all or nothing. You can have atrial fibrillation from time to time. And if you have atrial fibrillation, we need to ask the question with our doctor, what am I going to do to prevent a stroke? And it's not a one-size-fits-all answer. And you're right, the use of rat poison is virtually never our first choice. It's reasonable in some folks, but it's not usually what we'd think of anymore. But there are different answers. Some folks, if they know that they can eliminate some or most of the atrial fibrillation, they don't have to perhaps worry as much about the stroke. But the trouble is, doctors historically have answered the questions for their patients without telling their patients they were doing that. And what I mean by that is, if you came to me and you have some AFib, whether it's briefly or continuously, whether you feel it or whether you don't feel it, I'll make a decision about what's right for you and not even tell you that I did that without your consultation. And so as a person, ask your doctor, hey, what's my heart's rhythm? Do I have any AFib? Is it coming and going? And if I have that, doc, then what am I going to do to prevent a stroke? Is my current diet adequate? Should I take an aspirin? Should I be on one of the newer oral anticoagulants? And if so, which one and in what dose? Should I have a procedure to try to prevent a stroke? There are there are remarkably invasive things we can do to actually lower stroke risk, but not necessarily our first choice. Yeah. So there's a wide spectrum, and we really, really encourage people asking, hey, doc, what am I doing to prevent a stroke? I have AFib. Or, hey, doc, do I have AFib? Can you check?
Exactly. Well, we're running out of time, and, boy, it's been a great discussion, that's for sure. You Can Prevent the Stroke by Joshua Yamamoto and Kristen Thomas, the Foxhall Foundation. Get this book, and thanks so much for giving us some great information about the heart, Doc. Appreciate it, and have a great day.
Dr. Z, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.